Welcome to the Cotton Specialist Corner Podcast. I'm Steve Brown, Extension Cotton Agronomist at Auburn University, and with me are folks from different parts of the U.S. across the Cotton Belt, Dr. Fred Borland from Arkansas, Camp Hand and John Snyder from the University of Georgia, and Laurie Unruh Snyder from NC State. So welcome all. Well, let's start with some introductions. Fred, you've been at the University of Arkansas for a couple of years or so as a cotton breeder, but you've also examined other aspects of cotton management and growth and development. So give us an overview of your tenure at Arkansas.
Well, tenure at Arkansas began in May of 1948. That's when I was born here in Northeast Arkansas. But other than 30 years, I've been a student and 10 years down at Mississippi State University and then being a student down in Texas. I've been either in Northwest Arkansas or Northeast Arkansas all those 75 years. So at least a long tenure.
And you're a cotton breeder by trade, but again, you've investigated other things related to cotton, right?
Yes, that's right. We'll get into some work I did down at Mississippi State. I did a lot of work on seed and seedling, seed quality, the 10 years I was down there.
Camp and John, talk about your roles at the University of Georgia and your interest in cotton seed quality. Camp?
Yeah, so I'm the extension cotton specialist at the University of Georgia, coming up on my fourth crop. It's not quite 75, but we're on our way. And, kind of getting into this role and getting involved with the extension cotton specialist group, one thing that's been a priority for them to research is a little bit more on some of the seed quality stuff and kind of what's out there and what may be contributing to that. And of course, we're the extension folks, right? So our job is to disseminate the information. So we need people that are a whole lot smarter than us to help us out, like John and Laurie and Dr. Borland. So, definitely good to have this level of collaboration working on this issue, because it's a big one and it's complicated, right? Because it's a living thing, that seed. So, but yeah, I kind of see myself as contributing in that way to the Extension Cotton Specialist group and trying to find answers on this issue.
John, describe your training and background and then how you got involved in this issue.
Yeah, so I'm actually originally from Arkansas, and my bachelor's and master's was in biology, and then I got my PhD working in cotton physiology under Derek Oosterhaus. And, after a postdoc, I started here at the University of Georgia in Tifton in 2012. So I'm coming up, April 1st will be my 12th year. So anyway, when I first got here, really what kind of started my interest in seed, I say seed quality, I think it falls a little more under seedling vigor, but we can talk about that a little bit more later. But my interest there was that the year before I started this job was probably one of our worst years for stand establishment. There were a lot of problems related to, we had entire fields where we got almost nothing. And then there's other varieties that were coming up. And under the same situations, we had decent stands and others we didn't. And there was a lot of concern about seed quality at the time. And so, I partnered with my extension colleagues and we were doing research on farm. And really what we found was that there are certain seed traits that were pretty predictive of seedling growth and emergence and that type of thing, even when we had really high warm germ tests and even cool germ tests. So it wasn't so much, didn't seem to be related to whether or not that seed would germinate. It was more about, what was driving those early phases of seedling growth, I would say. But again, that's just sort of what started this for me. And I've been involved in some form of seedling vigor research ever since then.
Hey, Laurie, talk about your background and how you got involved in this topic at NC State.
Yes, I'm a associate professor at NC State, and my background, I'm actually from the Northeast. So I come in with this vision of learning about cotton without any bias, since I grew up on a corn and soybean farm, basically. But I got involved, how I kind of made my way to seed quality is as I finished my PhD, I did a postdoc with Jan Spears, who ran the seed lab here at NC State, and got a lot of good training with her background with seed quality, working with warm and cool germs of different crops. But then, I ventured off a little bit and did a little more forage science with forage seeds. But now the past 4 years have really heavily been focused on cottonseed quality. And I have so many fun things to share today, and I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, good. Our subject today is cottonseed quality, and there are multiple reasons that this is such a key issue, and I'm going to state several. But number one, that it's very obvious, but stand establishment launches the growing season, and viable, vigorous seed are critical to successful stand establishment. And all obviously, again, without an effective and consistent plant population, profitable yields are not possible. So that's number one. Number two, seed costs have risen dramatically since we entered the transgenic era in the mid-1990s. And prior to that, a bag of seed was a standard 50 pounds and cost somewhere between $30 and $35 per bag. And in the present day, a bag of seed includes a specific seed count per bag. And that the most common one is probably 230,000 seed per bag. And with premium seed treatments, a bag may sell for in excess of $800 in the Southeast. Yes, the transgenic era ushered in differential pricing by region, and the Southeast pays the most of anybody. But it also it really introduced or moved us into the golden era of the seed. And to summarize the point, farmers pay a high price for seed, and therefore they should receive a quality product. Number three, let's assume that the physical cost of just the seed may be somewhere in the neighborhood of $125. Maybe it's a little less than that. Maybe it's a little more, but not much different than that probably. And thus the cost of the pest management traits, the insect targeted traits or herbicide tolerance traits, these occupy a large majority of what the farmer pays for a bag of seed. And so from a company standpoint, they are delivering these very expensive and very valuable traits in and on a little bitty kernel we call a seed. And they, that is the seed company, the technology seed and technology company, therefore they need quality. They need that seed quality to not undermine the delivery of the whole package of the seed, that is the genetics for cotton, also the transgenes associated with pest management, and then also possible resistance built in to nematodes and bacterial blight. So quality matters from their standpoint as well. And then finally, it's been alluded to roughly, in recent years, there have been a few occasions where seed quality was substandard in parts of the eastern cotton belt. And that, coupled with what we've already stated, that's really increased our scrutiny on the issue of seed quality. And that's our discussion today. And I'll say it, it's a corny statement and it's improper grammar, and I know it, but the seed is where it's at. So, Camp, you and the Cotton Specialist Working Group have had two belt-wide projects on seed quality. Describe these and then the general findings from those projects.
Yeah, so the first one kind of started to with that instance that you're alluding to in the Eastern Cotton Belt, where there were some major seed quality issues over this direction. And, you know, it was something that needed to be investigated for sure. And so my former colleague, Murillo, kind of led that effort. And there was two, I guess, goals with that study. The first was, number one, to survey grower purchase seed and see what the quality of that is. So not necessarily the stuff that we're given to do research on, right? Because I would think the companies do not want to put a bad product out there, okay? But I would think that we may get some of the better stuff out of what they've got compared to some other things. But, you know, we wanted to see what's out there for grower purchase. And so, really, that was one of the biggest goals. I think we all had the mission of getting 10 different seed lots per state. And so that's what we did. And there was a lot of testing that went into that one, from warm and cool germ to all different sorts of fatty acid profiles. I know Laurie did some of the VMD work and oil and protein and all kind of stuff. So that was one goal of that. And then the other one was to try to tie some of those characteristics with those seed lots to field performance, right? And maturity over the season and stuff like that. And then, of course, yield at the end of the year is what matters. So that's the main goal of the first one.
One of the things we did was we swapped seed with growers, and we also got the company data on those bags. And roughly how well would you say they matched up overall?
I would say that, you know, majority of the time it was in line. with the non-biased data. You know, there of course is going to be some outliers out there, and you know, there just the amount of time between testing and stuff like that can attribute a little bit to that as well, because I think the law states that whatever is printed on that tag has to be done within 6 months, right, of being printed. So, you know, that kind of complicates things too, and the regulatory side of this is a whole other issue, right? But then, you know, really that first study pretty much showed that the majority of the seed that's out there for grower purchase is good. It's of good quality, you know, based on the parameters that we're using to evaluate that. And, you know, of course, there were some outliers out there. Maybe 5 to 10% of the samples were less than ideal. But overall, the majority of the stuff that's out there is of good quality. And so the next thing that we wanted to look at was kind of diving a little bit more into some specific seed lots and trying to tease out some of the differences of why certain things are performing better than others in the field with respect to stand establishment and stuff like that. So we worked very closely with some seed companies that were willing to work with us and got two different seed lots of 5 varieties. And so there was a quote unquote good seed lot and a bad seed lot according to the data that they had. And so we had a good and a bad seed lot for each variety. And so then we could kind of try to tease out within a variety, is there one of these characteristics that is attributing a little bit more to stand establishment in the field? So we did a lot of different tests on the seed, warm and cool germ. I even was having a conversation with somebody and they said, hey, you ought to do a tetrazoleum test just to see if the seed is even alive. You know, so we did that. Full free fatty acid profile, free fatty acids, oil percent, protein. You know, I mean, we tested just about everything we knew we could. You know, we were testing that kind of stuff. So
let me jump in again and say, what we had on lot A versus lot B, and you called lot B the poor lot,
right?
And either it was a lower warm germ number, lower cool germ number, or a higher seed count per pound, lowers a smaller seed,
right?
Typically the A versus B, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a good point to make. And we, for the majority of them, it was like that, where A had a higher warm germ and cool germ than B, let's say. But then on some of them, it was kind of neat that it just shook out this way. They had the exact same oil percent and nearly identical warm and cool germ. But the only thing that was different was that the seed size. And so, you know, even just looking to see how much seed size is contributing to this as well. And we're kind of working on getting that kind of stuff together. I know that our new colleague in our department here at Georgia, Dr. Preet Virk, she's going to look at some of that and kind of try to tease out what are the most influential things that we saw were contributing to stand establishment in these 10 seed lots across the Cotton Belt.
And another part of this, we planted those in 2022, and that same seed was planted again in 2023. So we did see
they were all retested in 2023 as well. So,
and we saw a significant decline in some of the quality measures, particularly warm or cool germ, right?
Yeah. So the first year, it was pretty right on with the company numbers. And then we, of course, did put those seed in cold storage. But by the time we planted them in 2023, I mean, some of those bags of seed were 3 years old, you know. So we did see a pretty drastic drop off in the warm and cool germ numbers with those seed lots. So, you know, it's going to be pretty neat to see how it all shakes out. You know, I was just kind of playing with it the other day, just based on what I've looked at, it kind of seems like the warm germ may be, you know, our best indicator in that big data set. I mean, you're talking 15 locations, you know, these 10 treatments, and it's 600 data points, something like that. We're trying to find the best indicators of seed quality. And, you know, I even did mine planted in April, whenever the NC State Planting Conditions Calculator said that planting conditions were marginal, and then I would do it in June also. And so we were trying to put it under some pressure and then have a more ideal situation in that June type timeframe where temperature wasn't our limiting factor. And really, at the end of the day, what was kind of interesting to me is that in both planting dates, we got pretty similar results. Like the seed lots that were good in April, it kind of held true that they were still the best ones whenever we planted a little bit later too.
One quick question. When you say cold storage, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we have a cold room. We maintain, it's about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. We keep a relatively, you know, I don't have controlled relative humidity on mine, but they did kind of make it to where I think they said that the best thing to do was to make sure that the temperature and the relative humidity, if you were to add those values together, it needs to be as close to 100 as possible is kind of what the guys told me. And so we had that for ours.
Okay, I know there's another project slated for 2024, but let's move on and we'll ask Laurie. Laurie, you became engaged in this project or this issue partly because of seed issues in the field that happened, I think, in, was it 2020? Was that when it happened?
I believe it was actually probably identified in 2019
okay.
or so. And then I was approached by our cotton extension specialist here in North Carolina State if I would be interested in the project. And I, of course, you know, having not worked with cotton before, I'm like, sure, I'll take the challenge and learn about cottonseed. And that has been what I have been doing now for the past 4 years, literally looking at one seed at a time, identifying if the seed has any damage and what specific location that damage is located in. And then I would grow out the seed to determine its ability to become a strong seed, like over 8 centimeters, or is it pure weak, 4 to 8, or is it abnormal? And is there a pattern in the damage location to what I'm seeing over time? And now I'm looking at, you know, that same pattern with different varieties. And is there a genetic influence or a seed size influence to that damage?
The industry refers to that as VMD.
Right, visual mechanical damage, correct.
Yes.
And so one thing I found fascinating working with this is that, you know, I worked with corn and soybean seed, forage seeds, weed seeds, and then I get to cotton and I'm like, okay, I can visually see, it's very easy to detect if there's damage, meaning if there's a saw blade or it appears to be a saw blade across the center of the seed, or if the seed's cracked on the chalazal side, and it kind of resembles, I call it the fish mouth, or, and the other way, if it's cracked on the radical end, I call it the whale's tail. I have all these fun names for these seeds to kind of keep it interesting with my students that work with me. But what we found is that we're looking at, you know, what's the probability that every time we open a bag of seed that we'll find, you know, 5 or 10 or 15% damage, or what's the level of damage in a bag of seed and how does it impact germination in the field. And for what we're seeing so far, you know, there is a correlation between the higher amount of damaged seed, the lower the percent germination. And so, you know, getting more specifically, what are the most dramatic cuts or damages that we can find in a bag that are going to wreak havoc to the farmer? And so what also I found very interesting in this work is that I got a chance to meet through Cotton Incorporated, the Australian seed producers. They came over and visited us in North Carolina and went to our fields. And I was like in shock that the percent VMD is actually located on their seed tag. So every farmer in, you know, that's planting cotton in Australia automatically knows that, you know, they have a certain percentage of VMD in their bag. And usually it's like less than 5% or so. But also I want to mention this. Unfortunately, it's confidential within working with seed companies, you know, to obtain that information. And also what I found when starting this research is that, you know, there wasn't anything reported in literature based, like, go back to the 60s and you find this like beautiful image of this lady, you know, sitting in front of her magnifying lens with her hair in a nice bun. And you know, there's basically three categories: very damaged, damage, and pinhole. So that's kind of all I had to work with getting started. And, you know, I kind of say to my student, let's do this one seed at a time and really figure this out. So we branched out and have very specific, what I call my 14 category sheet, where I'm identifying each location of damage, depending if it's on the chalazal end or on the radical end, or if it's in the center, the epicaudal. But in all, you know, you can have a bag of seed per se with a percentage of, I'll say, very damaged seed, maybe up to 6%. But if you're looking at the damaged category, which, let me back up, if something's very damaged, I can actually seed the embryo. That's what I'm calling a very damaged seed. But if you look at my quote, what I say, use a damaged category, that means there might be very obvious like cut on the seed, but the seed's not cracked open, at least what I can see with my naked eye. And so depending on where that crack is on the seed coat, some of those damaged categories can have a survivorship of 50%. So let's just say you have a bag and you have more damage than very damage. And let's just say the percentage is, you know, 30% and you have all damage. Well, you're looking at 50% of that 30%, 15% not surviving. So it really does matter what type of damage you have in the bag of seed. And what I'm going to eventually be publishing soon, the correlations between those damage types and percent of damage that could be linked to worm germ.
Do you and your colleagues, have y'all done any routine sampling of VMD in commercial bags on farm, or are you just limited?
So sample? Everything that I've been doing so far has been tied to the seed quality extension work. And so I continue to work in that space with the seed that they're provided with, so we can track, you know, multivariables against the very damage. So
I know you've taken hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures. Can someone access those on the internet?
At the moment, the work that I've done, everyone can look at I know I've been recorded at the meetings at the Cotton Beltwide, and also have papers in the Cotton Proceedings. But hopefully within the next, let's say, 3 months, I have a graduate student that will be completing her work, and we can make some of this more public with our images.
That'll be very interesting to see. I know I've seen some of them in some of your presentations. So
yes, but I think ideally what I realize I probably have the largest visual database and outcome of seeds, that it would be nice to try to find a way to make that more publicly available so people can see. You can't, you see an image and you can't deny what that image tells you. So I feel like, you know, there's power in visual. So I hopefully can make that more public available for people to look at and review.
Well, one related question, then we'll move to Fred. But do seed treatments have a way of putting like makeup, if you will, on the seed and covering up blemishes? What do you think about that?
I'll say that of all the seed evaluated, color can modify your ability to detect it. However, when you look at so many seeds, I can literally, you took off my contact lenses and glasses, and I'm at the point where I'm like a robot. I can tell you, I can see the damage. So, I mean, from a farmer's perspective, you know, and they're in the middle of the field with sun glaring down, it may be very hard to detect some of that damage. But I mean, we use micro lenses and macro lenses to pull up the best image we can, but it can be certainly covered. And I'm going to say this, like cottonseed can't avoid damage. Like, you know, it's going to have damage when it comes from either the stripper or the picker. It's going to get damage when it's going through the sawmill. But I think the information that we're gathering is going to be very vital to come up with the rapid assessment to help potentially make adjustments back in the ginning process to either, you know, dull the blades of the ginning process, or, you know, change the moisture of the seed, because you're getting much more, let's say, cuts or cracks, you know, in the seed itself. But I mean, it's inevitable, it's going to have damage. But it's just, you know, can we try to work more closely now with the companies to identify these are the two out of the 14 categories that I think should or could be reduced out of the bag of seed. And so it's just proving the data and providing the data, being open and you know, thorough about this. So hopefully there can be some changes in the future.
Well, Fred, in addition to your breeding program, you've also delved into this issue. So talk about some of your seed quality research.
Well, my real interest in seed and seedling research started, I guess, with my PhD dissertation. It was on inheritance and interrelationship of seed and seedling traits. And some of the seed traits we worked on was we looked at seed weight, seed volume, seed coat color, which was kind of an interesting area to look at, lint percent, Lenard's percent. And on seedlings, we measured speed of germination, speed of emergence, some speed of root development and hypocotyl length, and all those, and they're pretty mass amount of data. That interest, really, my interest in that area really mushroomed as I went to Mississippi State. They had an internationally known seed lab there located on campus, and I got working with them and interacting with them quite a bit. And I had several students, graduate students, to do research in the area of the seed and seedling traits. So it's been a long interest of mine. One of the kind of the general outcomes or things that I came up with is that I think the first thing you have to do is kind of separate seed, particularly if you're talking about vigor, to separate seed vigor and seedling vigor. Although, a bad seed vigor will contribute to poor seedling vigor, they're really somewhat distinguishable in the way I define it. The definition I end up with on seed vigor is that it resists deterioration. That is, it will maintain its germinability for a long period of time and under bad situations. So it's slow to deteriorate. We developed a hot water technique that really I thought was very superior to accelerated aging to be able to define that resistance to seed deterioration. For seedling vigor, I think I probably started off with the concept, and I think it's very tempting to divide seedling vigor as seedlings being large. And for several years, I would have students sample our plots, my breeding plots, and we would look at sublethal seedling disease occurrence. And by the way, that's one of the, I think, most phenomenal things that's happened in seeding seedlings over the last 30 years is what companies have done with these seed treatments. As late as in the 90s, I could very confidently here in North Arkansas go out in any field and pull up some plants and show you sublethal seedling disease. Now that's not the case. I hand it to the pathologists and the people developing those seed treatments. But anyway, we would have these tests since we already had the seedlings pulled. I would have them measure the height and fresh weight and dry weights. And in the year, I'd put those and analyze, and we'd get significant difference between strains and varieties each year. I'd put it in my tables as seedling vigor. Well, I finally got around to correlating that to yield and found that my seedling vigor measurements had no correlation to yield, and which told me that I wasn't measuring seedling vigor correctly. So in rethinking that, we came up with three definitions of seedling vigor. Now, this is different from seed vigor, but seedling vigor is, first of all, is low seedling disease incidence, that it resists seedling disease. Secondly, in developing good root, one thing we found is that some of those seedlings that were shorter, that didn't have as much fresh weight and dry weight, actually had better root development. So, the plant is kind of, I'm not sure, and I'm always scared with physiologists on the line, that it's according to how the carbohydrates are being distributed. And then the third was a rapid true leaf development. And kind of the idea there is that the only good seedling, only real vigorous seedling is one that's no longer a seedling. And we found a line that I've still been playing with. I've never released it, but it has a differentiated true leaf when it emerges, very much like a soybean plant.
Wow.
The only problem, it doesn't have very good penetrance. A population doesn't, once you select it, I can only get it up to about 60% of the plants, and I've had some more issues with it, but that's a long story. But I still think that is a very, we did do some inheritance and found that it has a a fair degree of a good inheritance. So it should be able to develop, but I haven't been successful to do that. But I think that's really the key to a good seedling is one that's no longer a seedling. As long as it's a seedling, that little plant's going to be vulnerable to everything that walks by it. So I think that should be our goal.
I have a question, Fred, relating to what you call the sublethal seedling disease. If a plant has that, and it, which means it's going to recover, does it yield normally? What do you think about that?
Oh, you will definitely stunt the growth. Now, it can, if it's got enough time, it may be able to recover. There's some work done, oh gosh, back in the 50s that showed that, you know, different amount of this amount of seedling disease would hinder the plant development. And that was a major factor, even I think up into the 80s and 90s in terms of production of a lot of varieties.
Okay. I want to detour a moment because I've heard one of your colleagues, and I think you were involved in some research on variable seeding rates. What has been your determination on seeding rates and their impact on yields?
Well, I'm not sure where you got that question because I have done some on seedling rates, not a great deal, but I'm involved with some folks, Tina Teague and some folks over at Arkansas State right now. And it's quite remarkable to me. They're going down to some extremely low rates that has little effect on yield, you know, going down to one plant per foot. And that is that's getting down about 13,000, plants per acre. And I know some work, oh gosh, in Oklahoma back in the 50s, they showed a little difference between one plant per foot up to, you know, four or five. But, you know, one of the issues that I concerns, not an issue, a concern I have, particularly in our area, if you start reducing that plant density, obviously the driving force is the cost of the seed. That's what they're really wanting to reduce, the number of seed they're planting. Certainly the improvements of seed treatments that is allowing them to do that from the standpoint of seedling disease. But one of the concerns I have in our areas, we have a lot of fields with some verticillium wilt. And one way you can increase verticillium wilt is by decreasing the number of plants, plant density. So I'm not sure. And at the same time, we're a lot of times going with some high nitrogen rates and water. We're kind of doing all the formula to increase verticillium wilt. So we may be setting ourselves up for some other issues there.
Okay. I have another side question. Then I'm going to follow that up with you, Camp, and anybody else if they want to veer into this one. If a farmer in Arkansas plants 100 seed, how many plants is he going to see, he or she going to see visible, countable in about 20 days?
Well, here in North Arkansas, you'll probably see several hundred, but most of them are pigweeds. You just asked the number of plants. So we
number
have a lot of plants.
Cotton plants. We're talking cotton plants, not weeds.
If you're planting 100, you know, if we're getting 70%, we're doing, I think we're doing very well.
Okay.
And that's another issue with that one per row foot. If you may end up with some skips, and that's a whole different issue.
Yeah, it becomes much trickier if you're at 70%. Yes. Okay, Camp, what do you think in Georgia?
Right. Yeah, so, you know, even just kind of doing this experiment that we're talking about, some of the seed quality work, doing it in multiple locations, I've learned a lot about the level of emergence may depend on the field, right? It may depend on the person driving the tractor, okay? Because, you know, we did the trial here in Tifton, and I was planting it, and we get about 65-70%, okay, on average, right? And some of that's, you know, poor seed lots, and some of it's good and all this stuff. And Doc Brown's pointing at me. He says it's my fault. And but then we go up to Midville, where Travis is the tractor man for me up in Midville, and we can get 80-90%. You know, and Doc Brown says thumbs up to that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, it could even be soil type. It could be, you know, the efficiency of the planter that you're using. It could be, you know, the person on the tractor, right? So there's a lot of things that go into that. But, of course, with as much as seed is, Doc Brown, and if the seed is where it's at, then it ought to be 100 come up is what it should be. But yeah, that's kind of what I see.
I would say a good number in Alabama would be 80, but I would say the range is going to be anywhere from maybe the low 60s to almost 90 and maybe a little more than 90 under great conditions with irrigation. But again, I think most people should think in that range of about 80%. So,
and I would contribute to this answer, given that you have the perfect planting conditions, you know, knowing now that I can tell you the percent VMD and the type of VMD being if it's very damaged or damage and the rate of survivalship of that seed, you know, I would go anywhere from, you know, 80 to, you know, could be as low as 65 or even 60, depending on the percent VMD. So, you know, that's kind of what my goal is to try to figure out how we can, you know, do a little bit more specific in-house testing to predict maybe the possibility of what it's going to do with the emergence data. So
I'll interject a statement here that I will say, I don't say with absolute confidence, but when I was with the company, I think they generally wanted to see VMD at 10% or less. Now, there may have been some exceptions. No question there have been some exceptions, but they would probably target a something like that. They might even target in some situations as low as 5%. But I'd be curious, Laurie, just one quick answer. What was the range reported from Australia on, since they were publishing it on the bag?
It's usually, I think, 5% or less. And they won't sell anything that has 5% or more. That's, they're trying to figure out what those exact causes of the VMD are to make sure that they're not harvesting during it really dry times, or, you know, avoiding at all costs the processing of cotton that causes the damage. So that to eliminate those issues right away. So I know it's probably a little bit more difficult to do that here in the United States with seed production, but there is newer technologies coming out every day that, you know, you're able to detect two different colors, and you know, the embryo is yellow and the seed is, for the most part, if it's black seed or dark brown seed. So it should be easily detected and could be easily removed just depending on the resources available.
Okay, John Snyder, talk about your research in this whole area.
All right. Well, yeah, as I was kind of mentioning earlier, you know, where I got started on this was looking at really seed characteristics that would indicate seedling vigor in these large on-farm trials. And again, Dr. Borland, I'll go ahead and just, you know, just tell you at the front end, most of what we measure are the same things that you say may not be the best indicators of vigor. But, you know, in working with my colleagues across the belt as well, there's some pretty standard measures that make their way into the literature, like fresh weight, dry weight. And again, it's always above ground because that's easier, of course, to measure than having to work with roots. So just to kind of tell you some of what we found was in the majority of production environments in Georgia, for example, the size, or let's say the mass of a seed and its composition were both important indicators of seedling vigor. So, for example, if you have a large seed, you know, the thought there is that there's a couple of things that are contributing to greater seedling vigor, seedling growth under those field conditions. And the first thing is that a larger seed, in theory, should have more, a higher energy content available to drive that early seedling growth from the time that that radical protrudes out of the seed coat till it breaks up above the surface and those cotyledons start photosynthesizing. But the other thing is that cotyledons tend to be larger in larger seeded cultivars. So you have two things happening there. One is, you know, possibly affecting whether or not that seed emerges. And then the other thing is that once those cotyledons are open, they're bigger, they're catching more light, and that's able to fuel more rapid early season growth. So, you know, that trend has held true for us in a lot of different situations, whether we were looking at that across different production environments within the state. We followed that up with different planting date studies. And in particular, when we plant under cooler early season temperatures, the seed mass does seem to be, again, that seems to hold true, that that's fairly predictive of stand establishment. And again, early season plant growth, crop growth rates. And kind of going back to something that Dr. Borland stated was in our situation, when we were looking at these seed characteristics, seeds that had higher energy content per seed, they also, it seemed like they had a greater rate of first true leaf development. So those leaves, they basically develop area faster. And that led to more aggressive early season growth. So
you said higher energy level. How would you describe that?
So that's a great question, because what, you know, whenever you think about the main constituents of that cottonseed that we would think of as, let's say, food reserves, right? Then you've got protein and you've got oil. And so how that is split, you know, what fraction of that seed is protein? What fraction of that is oil? Well, if you've got a higher oil content in that seed, we know that oil basically gets a higher calorie count than protein does. So that's how I've standardized a lot of my work is we have a seed mass, we know the percent oil, we know the percent protein, and we know that, you know, oil gets twice the calorie count that protein does. And so, yeah, so that's how we did our estimates, was as a total calorie count for those two constituents for that planted seed.
You would say there is a relationship between seed oil content and vigor.
Yes. You can see a situation where a large seed, let's say it has a really low oil content, it may not have that energy content, right? So it's a combination of those two things. Yeah.
And you would agree with Fred on that you have seed vigor and you have seedling vigor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you think about germination tests, we're really looking at that seed phase, right? Once that radical protrudes, we're now in the seedling phase. And actually, when that happens, that's where that seedling is mobilizing those lipid reserves and turning that into new growth, whether that's the growth of the root system or the shoots.
Do you think farmers see those differently? Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I want to comment on this because I hear this referred to, I would say, incorrectly, and I don't just want to blame farmers, my colleagues, my students. I don't want to just throw farmers under the bus here. We say germination, we apply that to everything, right? And that usually it's taken to mean emergence, right? And that's okay. I mean, I've probably done it myself, okay? But more correctly, you know, that germination is strictly when that radical protrudes beyond that seed coat, whereas, you know, emergence, we're actually dealing with a seedling, right? We're in that seedling phase, and that becomes a seedling vigor issue, getting from germination to a seedling that's above that soil surface. So I appreciate that question for sure.
Is there a relationship between seed vigor, seedling vigor, and yield?
So I'm going to also kind of back Dr. Borland up on this one. So every time, and again, we're dealing with company seed that we have received that honestly is pretty high germination rates, cold, warm, whatever. Most of what I get has pretty high germination rates as it is. So I don't have things that are at the extreme low end. But from a seedling perspective, if we look at those early season growths, no, I don't typically see a relationship, negative or positive, between seedling vigor and yield. And that's looking at it across a lot of different production environments.
All right. One question related to that. Okay. Is in Camp's project 2.0, you had seed of the same variety that was good lot, not so good lot. In some of my plots, there were no differences. But if you have A and B, if we describe them as good and not so good, does that translate into yield necessarily?
Yeah, so it doesn't have to, but if you get it's just like anything. Cotton has the ability to compensate to a point, right? We were talking about some of those low seeding rates that produce just as high a yield as some of the higher seeding rates. So once you get below a threshold there will be a yield penalty at some point, you know, but you have to limit stand establishment would have to be limited to the point that you'd actually see that. And then the other thing is that, you know, do we have a sufficient growing season length also to mature that? Because when you have lower stand counts, what you would expect is that it would take a little longer for those individual plants to mature as well. So there's a lot of things going on all at once, of course.
It differs a lot, South Georgia versus up here in Northeast Arkansas. It's got what John's talking about. We can run it. You know, we already got two strikes against us when we plant up here. And if you got low seed quality, you're kind of adding, maybe you're not a whole strike, but you're really increasing your risk factor that's already pretty risky.
Yeah, in the lower Southeast, we have such a long growing season that we can overcome and compensate and so forth. And we don't stand the backdoor penalty that you're going to have in the more northerly parts of the U.S. Cotton Belt. So
we've got a pretty broad planting window that we can work with here.
So what else have you focused on in your seed quality research, John? Any other comments you want to make?
Sure. So really looking at temperature responses, of course, and again, some of the seed traits still, that holds true. But I was glad that Dr. Borland mentioned roots. It's not something that I work a whole lot with, but we did have a postdoc working in our lab that was looking at, we selected varieties from the on-farm trial based on seed mass, but it turns out they, some of these cultivars also had differences in their root traits. So the number of vascular bundles that you have inside a root actually will determine how many secondary roots that plant forms. And overwhelmingly, whether we looked at it under cool temperatures, warm temperatures, whatever, but plants that had a particular type of root anatomy that had more vascular bundles, those were ones that grew more aggressively, irrespective of growth temperature conditions. And when I say grew more aggressively, that's specifically looking at the root system. And I do think that's something that we ignore, that we really shouldn't, because the majority of cotton's biomass, I would say, until you start getting into flowering, is the root system.
One project I was involved in many years ago at UGA there actually was looking at the effect of thrips and the damage of thrips on plants. And what we saw above ground in terms of growth and injury was reflected underground. Now, what you're suggesting is that we may have different varieties that actually have a different composition of that in terms of above ground and below ground, correct?
Well, so what I'm saying is that cotton just in general puts more growth into the root system early on. That's across the board, right? But I agree with you on that, the root and shoot growth. What we find is whether we're looking at variety or temperature, it does seem, everything I've looked at least, in controlled environment conditions too, where we can get at the root system and get the whole thing, where we have better shoot growth, we have had actually better root growth as well. The two seem to be pretty highly correlated, at least when we were looking at temperature and cultivar. Yeah,
I'll chase a little rabbit here. We wanted to get some, I have a colleague who's done some root characterization, some very sophisticated work, looking back over decades of varieties to see what the root composition was. And we could not, unfortunately, get our hands on Delta Pine 555 because we think it had a different root pattern than anything else, but we couldn't do that. So it had a very deep tap root in most situations. So
it had a different fruit distribution pattern too. So it seemed like it would set fruit a little bit, like for long growing season environments, it was ideal because it would set fruit a little bit, like start setting a little bit later, and it was over a broader distribution. And that allows that plant to just continue more vegetative growth, including roots, before it gets into setting fruit, which tends to slow all the other vegetative growth down.
Now, you and your colleagues, that maybe it's you, I've heard you have initiated a course there at UGA on seed quality. Is that correct?
Well, so I do teach 2 to 3 courses a year, but none of them are actually on seed quality. I teach a couple of physiology courses and then crop production, crop science, you know, so multiple classes. But what I will say is, so what I think you're referring to is a former student of mine is now a faculty member here. And so there was a seed technology course that kind of stayed dormant for a while, and she has picked that up, and it's interesting, you know. So I noticed this today as I was looking through, you know, I was walking down the hall and one of my colleagues stopped me and said, you know, how impressed the students were with that course. So I'm glad that at least we're getting you know, some basic knowledge on seed technology and seed quality, because there's, for a long time, we didn't have that. And that was, I think, a key course. I don't know if that's something lacking from a lot of other programs, but I'm definitely glad that we've started this.
I believe the seed's where it's at. I poked and prodded on this. Lori, are you involved in courses at?
Yeah, I'm actually teaching a seed physiology class. Right. And I was going to say, it really makes a difference if you're like teaching it like online or distance ed, but I was shocked. Like we said, all right, let's offer the Seed Phys class online. I have 15 students this semester, the largest population I've had, and they're generally all very interested. I mean, you really kind of have to be interested when you take the subject because, you know, it's not something that a lot of people seem to like want to have a conversation over coffee with unless I'm with this group. But I mean, I'm very impressed with their interest. You know, they want to know like what advanced seed treatments are out there. Like they're interested in so many, you know, not just cotton, but other crops. But I have really enjoyed this semester's group of students and their interest in seed science. So I'm glad I teach this class and hopefully we'll continue to do so.
Any other courses at NC State relating to seed technology, seed quality, or are you the course?
I'm the course. I mean, I do think that it's mentioned briefly in the, you know, commodity groups class, but I think by the time they're coming into my class, it's really, they're learning for the first time the details into, you know, conducting studies and running, you know, a true seed set up an experimental design. So it's, I usually pick up at least two or three more grad students every time I teach this class. And that's usually what happens. They realize they missed out on a lot of other, you know, basic core information that will make an impact as, you know, they want to become extension agents and work, you know, with applied knowledge. And they're like, oh, well, we really need to start with the seed. I'm like, absolutely. If you don't have the right quality, then you're going to get what you get in the field and you need to know why. So it's having that open mind and knowledge that's really nice to share with them.
Fred, how about at Arkansas? Are there courses on this issue?
No, I'm 300 miles away. So if there is, I'm not aware of that. We did have one section of advanced crop science that taught some, that covered some of it, but I don't think in very much detail, particularly from perspective of cotton.
Now, you were at Mississippi State and you talked about doing a lot of detailed investigations on this issue because of the good seed program that they've had at that institution.
Yeah.
And I've sort of poked and prodded at my friends there that, hey, why did y'all, how could they possibly let that go away? Because the seed is so important. Yeah. So talk about that a minute.
Yeah, that was, when I was there, they had, I think four or five faculty, and they had a tremendous number of international contracts. So they traveled all over the world and had a seed. I forgot what it was called. It was a course that would, they bring people in, a short course type thing for just focused on seed each year. But those faculty retired one way or the other or moved. And as I understand, there's very little, I don't know what they have going now. But it's certainly not the magnitude they had at that time. But they had all the equipment. I learned a great deal using gravity tables and all this type of things that I was not aware of. So that was a very good experience for me. I was on several of their students' committees and gained a great deal of knowledge from that.
I do think, and I'll make this statement, who will listen to me, but I do think that the land-grant institutions have got to beef up this area because the seed are so critical to what we do and more is going into the seed. And so its importance is elevated immensely, and yet we need more teaching and development of information related to seed quality. So I'm preaching to the choir. I realize that. So, all right, a couple of final questions, and I don't know whoever would like to answer, how would you rate overall seed quality today in the U.S. cotton industry? Who would like to comment?
That's a tough question. Again, it goes back to how you define vigor. I've been very impressed listening to Lori and John. I'm glad I'm not the only one some of these concerns. But I would think, you know, particularly, I think there's been a great deal of advance in seed treatments. I think that for the most part, the seed that we get from seed companies today are a lot higher quality than they were 30 and 40 years ago. And I applaud them for that in terms of just the consistency they have. We used to have what they put in bag was a lot more variable, a lot more of the cut seed that Lori mentioned, that types of things that some of them, I thought they may have swept them off the floor. But from my perspective, it's greatly improved from what it was 20 and 30 years ago.
I would like to add to that, that, you know, I do think the project that was started back in 2020 that brings all of us together talking about this topic, looking at, like, as John mentioned, the protein, the oil, the fatty acids, we can't just go on what we see. We actually have to know the science, the seed itself, the energy. You know, I'll go back and reiterate what John said. That's so important. We can go on, you know, warm germ and cool germ, but if we don't know, like, you know, percent oil or overall percent fatty acid or distribution of these fatty acids, how can we really get to the root of advancing the science if we're not all working together? And that's what I love about this project, is that every aspect from the field to the lab to the chemistry is involved in it, so that we can really get to the core of what the future holds for seed quality for cotton.
I would say, you know, and kind of going back to the first project, that overall quality is good, you know, but there are slip ups, right? Some things slip through the cracks. And I mean, part of that might be trying to estimate if a seed lot is going to break dormancy, or, you know, different things like that complicate this issue too. And kind of like Laurie just said, I mean, the seed thing is complicated because, I mean, it is still a living organism and there's so much going on in there that you can't predict some of these things, right? But, you know, the companies do not want to put a bad product out there. And so I think in most cases, they're not purposefully going to do so. But, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, slip ups happen and things get into the market and crazy stuff happens. You know, Dr. Brown, you drop it from a certain height, you know, that might do something. You leave it in a truck for a long time, it might, you know, affect the seed another way. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is complicated. But overall, I would say that I think that, you know, most of the seed that's out there available for growers to purchase and plant in the field is good. But, you know, if you are concerned about that, there are the two tests that, you know, Laurie kind of alluded to, were the warm and cool germ. And those are the best indicators today that we have. But we're trying to, you know, even refine some of that even more and try to make it better, too. So, you know, it's complicated, but I think that most of the seed that's out there is good.
And I do think, agreeing with Lori, that the shining light of science is helpful to the whole process. And it does put the pressure on the industry. But if you think about it again, and for the lower Southeast, we're paying 20 times more than what we used to pay for seed. Okay. Now, and they have all this fancy and inexpensive technology that we value and appreciate and benefit from, riding on the seed. So making the seed as best that we possibly can is good for the entire industry. And again, I do think the science has put some pressure on them that I think is good. And farmers are paying a high price for that, and they should get a good product. So I appreciate everybody that's looking at this. And again, it's certainly nudging, I think, quality forward, I hope. So, all right. For the 2024 crop, maybe this, I don't know if John and Lori would be involved with this, but certainly Campus. What advice do you have producers as they prepare to put the 2024 crop in the ground? If anybody can respond to this.
I think the key is to know what you got. You know, I mean, if you're going out there and you know, let's say in Georgia, I mean, here in the next 2 weeks, some folks might think about jumping out there. And if we're going to be doing something like that, well, I'd want to be a little more confident in what I've got sitting in my shed, and maybe position some things if we're going to plant early, as opposed to planting in our on time window or maybe even a little bit delayed. So, you know, the key for growers here is, if you're concerned about this, then, you know, you should get it tested. And I know that many states across the Cotton Belt have parts of their Department of Ag that are dedicated to this. I know that a lot of the states in the Cotton Belt have really started putting a lot of emphasis on this, especially, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, I know, has a program. Alabama has one, Dr. Brown. So, you know, there is definitely a place for that. And, you know, I think you got to know what you have and know what you're about to put in the ground. And, you know, if you got some stuff that maybe isn't exactly where you want it to be on cool germ, then, hey, maybe let's wait and plant that stuff on time, as opposed to planting it in our more adverse conditions. You know, and here in Georgia and even to an extent South Alabama, you know, we've got this long planting window, and so we can do that, you know. But in places like the Carolinas, Virginia, Arkansas, like Dr. Borland's talking about, you're already starting with your back against the wall, you know, so you may not be able to position these things across the broad planting window that we have in the lower Southeast, but, you know, we can definitely put things in a position to be successful. It's just like choosing a variety, right? You want to put a variety in a position to be successful, and there's certain varieties that are going to be better for certain situations than others. It's the same conversation with seed quality. If you know what you have, you can put it in a better position to be successful and get off to a good start.
Yeah. So in addition to just echoing what Camp said, you know, how do you know what kind of conditions you're planting into? And that's what I'm just going to say is there's that plant cotton planting conditions calculator. If you had to pick something that, you know, to make those decisions, it was developed by North Carolina State University, use the cotton planting conditions calculator. And, you know, if you're looking at something that you might need to, if you're looking at more marginal conditions because you don't have a choice, I think, you know, deciding where to place those, I think temperature is as good as anything, because that's kind of what we've seen is where the varieties really seem to separate out in terms of seedling vigor is under those cooler planting conditions. So anyway, that's all I've got.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
Things that just overwhelms me is these farmers are 12 row planters planting 20 miles an hour. And I'm not sure. My one advice is slow down a little bit, or at least, you know, double check that depth of planting. There's a lot of things can go wrong, and it'll haunt you the rest of the year. So, you know, make sure everything is right, certainly before you start going that fast through the field.
And I'd say for the lower Southeast, for much of our area, temperature is not the deciding factor. It's soil moisture. So when we get out, unless we have unusually cool temperatures, which we actually had in 2023, if we have moisture sometime in mid to late April, if I'm a dry land producer and it takes me considerable time to plant, I've got to proceed. And just again, moisture is a greater limiting factor here most years for us than is temperature. So, all right, I'm going to finish with this. Our library was getting rid of some old books, and I actually happened to pick up the 1961 Yearbook of Agriculture, and the title is Seeds. And I picked it up, and here's a poem that was written by someone in the New York Times, actually G.S. Galbraith, and in 1960, New York Times. It's a poem called On a Seed. And this is at the first page of the Yearbook of Agriculture, 1961. This is it. This was the goal of the leaf and the root. For this did the blossom burn its hour. This little grain is the ultimate fruit. This is the awesome vessel of power. For this is the source of the root and the bud. World unto world remolded. This is the seed, compact of God, wherein all mystery is unfolded. That's a poem on seed. So hopefully this has been a fun discussion, a helpful discussion on a key issue for producers and others across the U.S. Cotton Belt. So we do appreciate our listeners joining us for this session of the Cotton Specialist Corner podcast. We appreciate Cotton Incorporated and their sponsorship and promotion of this project and the insights of Camp Hand, Fred Borland, Lori Snyder, and John Snyder. So thanks one and all.